Hello, everybody. So my name is James McNellis. I'm a software development engineer on the Visual C++ team. I'm currently responsible for our C standard library implementation, which is decidedly legacy code. It's been around longer than I have. So I'm going to talk today about a few techniques that we've been using, we've been applying from modern C++ development to try and improve the quality of that legacy code base and other legacy projects that we've been working on. So I guess I wanted to start off, how many people here are working on a large C++ code base? An old C++ code base? Yeah. Okay. So C++ from 20 years ago looks very different from C++ today. Our goal is not necessarily to bring it up to the latest and greatest and make everything awesome, but it is to make gradual improvements to code to make it more debuggable, more maintainable. So I want to start off with a few examples of what we mean by legacy C++ code. And so one of the benefits of working on our C standard library implementation is we've shipped the source code for many releases, so it's a bountiful source of terrifying code. So in our implementation, we have this function called output, and you can go and take a look at it in the sources if you have Visual Studio installed. It's in output.c. And this function, basically, it's the core implementation of printf. So it does all of the formatting of things and writing to either a stream or a string or a console for all the different variations of printf. And a long time ago, it started off looking fairly normal. We're just going to look just at the declaration of this function. So it's a big function, but it's fairly simple. It takes a file star and a format and a list of arguments. So then at some point in time, we realized, we also need to support wide characters, Unicode strings. And so the way this was done, because this was a C implementation, was we went and we added some ifdefs. So we started compiling the code twice, once for Unicode, once for ANSI strings. And so the implementation started to look like this. And throughout, if we were to look at the definition, we would see that there's a whole bunch of ifdef Unicode throughout the code, and we've used tcare everywhere instead of care. So then a few years later, we decided, not only do we want to support normal printf format strings, we also want to be able to do positional format specifiers, kind of like what is done in C#. So we went ahead and we added another set of ifdefs. And so now we have a wOutput_p and an output_p in addition to the wOutput and output that we had before. And then throughout this code, there's a whole bunch of duplicated code guarded by this positional parameters macro. So then a couple more iterations later, and the declaration of this function, I kid you not, looks like this. This is only half of the declaration. There's 12 functions there, but I would challenge you to even try and figure out what arguments go with what functions, or it's near impossible to debug. So this file in Visual Studio 2013 is 2,700 lines long. This one function spans 1,500 lines of code. And I've been telling people that there were 195 ifdef control blocks in this file. I was actually wrong. I went and recounted. There are 223. So this code is practically impossible to maintain. The maintenance difficulty posed by this, this accumulation of technical debt actually prevented us from shipping some features in the last release. So one of the things that we implemented for Visual Studio 2013 is we started adding some of the new C99 library features to the library. And so other members of our team worked on new math library functions and new conversion functions. And we looked, we needed to add some new format specifiers to these functions. And we realized there was just no way we could actually implement it, given the few months of time that we had, without, and still have a very high confidence that we hadn't broken everything. So this is, a real problem, moving forward. So as another completely different example, there's another function in the C runtime called popen. And what this function does is it starts up a child process and it pipes the output or input to a file star in the calling process. And if we get to the end of the function, it looks something like this, which has a whole bunch of labels, which indicates that throughout the file or throughout the function, there are a whole bunch of go-tos to jump to these cleanup places. And so heaven help us if we tried to go in and add some other new resource that needed to be cleaned up and needed to make sure that there were no leaks. I actually do think that there are a couple of leaks in here on obscure error cases, but hopefully no one is running into them. So finally, I have a third example, which is unfortunately fairly new code from MSDN. And I can't fit the entire example on the slide, so we're just going to look at the first few lines that look something like this. Have anybody seen code that looks something a lot like this? So this is definitive arrow code. It's code that, you know, you see it coming in on the top, and then on the bottom it's gonna come back out as you close all the braces and clean everything up. So this isn't really as bad as the other two, but it's terrible C++ practice. It's not using RIII, so we can't make the code linear. And my reaction, you know, when I come across code examples like these is something like this. So for the purpose of this talk, we're going to define legacy C++ code as code that doesn't follow what we consider to be the best C++ development practices. Now, that doesn't mean that the people who wrote it, you know, didn't know what they were doing. In many cases, it's just that 20 years ago, development practices were very different. Compilers were very different. We're not able to do as much optimization as they do today. So oftentimes, you did whatever it took to make the code run fast. In many cases, we have C code that now we're trying to maintain, and we want to use C++ features, and that becomes very difficult because of some of the limitations in the original C implementations. Most importantly, though, it's not necessarily old code. So in many cases, you know, it's code that's been around for a while, but it's been maintained over time. And oftentimes, when maintaining code, we go in and we say, oh, well, it's already kind of like this. So if I go and, you know, add, oh, just one more layer to that arrow code, it's not a big deal. You know, what's one more layer? Or in the case of the ifdefs, you know, oh, what's one more, you know, way of compiling this code? And so this is a real problem, and this is why it's very important, you know, to continue improving old code. Often there's a resistance to improving old code because it's not broken. Let's not touch it. Let's not fix what's not broken. So I think it is important that, you know, we should update code, you know, during regular maintenance. If you're already going in to fix a bug, you know, try and tidy things up and make things better. In addition, you know, if you have a component whose interface or whose design is impacting other new development that you're working on, it's also important there to go and try and improve old components if it's negatively impacting new development. And finally, and I've got an example in here that it's important that if we have critical components, especially security critical components, that we should be auditing them on a regular basis. And several recent news stories have, you know, been very good examples of why this is important. So I want to start off. There's a couple of really great books on this subject of refactoring and updating legacy code. Martin Fowler's book on refactoring is the definitive work on the subject. It's not C++ specific, but it's it has a lot of great examples and of how to refactor code. And then Michael Feather's book on working effectively with legacy code is a really great resource. These are more general resources. I'm going to focus on a few specific examples of using C++ techniques to improve legacy code. So I also want to note that, you know, a lot of times when people think of C++, you know, modern C++, they think, oh, all these new C++ 11 features like variadic templates and lambdas and other things. And, you know, they get terrified when we see things that look like this. And this is actually an example from our C++ standard library. And I want to make very clear that that's not, you know, what we're aiming for. We want code that's very easy to understand. Code like this is great in libraries, which is where this is from. But, you know, in most of our application code and even in most library code, it should be very straightforward, very easy to understand, very easy to debug. So if you do nothing else, I have two recommendations that can drastically help your code. The first is to turn up the warning level. With Visual C++, we strongly recommend compiling with W4, not WAll, because that actually enables all of the warnings, including useless ones, like, oh, you've got extra padding in this struct, which most people generally don't care about. There's a lot of usually bad things that are valid C++, and some of this comes from our heritage, you know, of being derived from C. Some of this comes from, you know, the long history of development of C++. And the compiler really wants to help you. Like, we have tons of warnings in there for a reason. Most of them are in there because we've discovered, you know, real production code in Windows or Office or in customer code bases where, oh, we've had major issues that we want to go and clean up. So The most important thing I want to note here is that it doesn't have to be like all at once. You just go and enable W4 and suddenly you've got 10,000 warnings and have to fix them all at once. For our projects, usually when we introduce new warnings, we'll gradually go through and like we'll enable them for individual projects and slowly update one project at a time and ratchet up the warning level on each project. So, you know, maybe we'll go to W3 first and we'll fix all the warnings there, and then we'll enable a few W4 warnings and then a few more. And then eventually all of the code is compiling at a higher warning level. Most things here are very easy to fix, and oftentimes we'll identify bugs that are easy to fix. So for example, we have a whole set of warnings that'll warn you anytime you mix unsigned and signed types and expressions, because anytime you do that, you can often end up with weird errors due to conversions, because unsigned types generally win, so you end up with negative numbers becoming very large positive numbers, and that's not usually what is expected by the programmer. And so as an example of where warnings help, does anyone remember code like this from the news recently? Perhaps in some security critical products? This is something that almost any compiler can warn you about. Dead code detection is trivial for a compiler to go and say, oh look, this code is never reached, you know, by any valid code path. So enabling these sorts of warnings can help you, you know, to find these sorts of errors. Second, and I hope there's no C programmers in here that I'm going to offend, if you have C code, it is really important to convert it to start compiling a C++. And there's two reasons for this. The first is that you do get better type checking because C++ has much stricter rules, especially with pointers, as we'll see in a moment. But second, and more importantly, is you can take advantage of more advanced C++ facilities. And I'm not talking about variadic templates or crazy, you know, overloading tricks, but you know, even just things like simple templates to go and do generic programming. As an example, you know, if we think back to that printf function, you know, we could easily use templates to solve a lot of that and eliminate most of the complexity. The conversion process is usually straightforward. There's only a handful of, you know, little backward incompatibilities. Like I said, any of the type errors that that are valid C obviously would need to be addressed. Things like, you know, using new C++ keywords as identifiers would need to be fixed. But generally, this is a fairly straightforward process. So this is an example of something that is valid C. So what we have here is we have an array of doubles, and we're passing it to this fill array function that takes an array of unsigned integers. And this is totally valid C. It's going to go and do that pointer conversion, no problem. C++ will balk at this, and you know that's totally not valid. All right, so I want to talk about a few preprocessor abuses and how to try and get away from them. So in principle, every if def, you know, every one of these directives that starts a new conditional compilation block increases complexity of the code because it can be compiled in different ways and you have to go and hunt down what flags are currently being used for each compilation of a file. And it makes the code harder to understand and maintain. So if we go back and we think about just that output function we had when we had both Unicode and ANSI, we can see that that could easily be transformed into a template here, right? Where we make the character a template parameter, and then we just have the output and WOutput functions delegate to it. Now, yes, there's more code here, but it's much simpler. It's easier to understand. We can look at these two functions. We know exactly what they do, and then this, you know, the main function itself has all of the logic. It's very easy to understand. So in general, these sorts of transformations are fairly easy. It depends. Obviously, when you have 223 ifdefs in a file, it's a bit more difficult than, you know, just a straightforward transformation like this. But this can really help improve code quality. So sometimes it's okay to have ifdefs, though. Obviously, if you have to do different things for 32-bit or 64-bit code, or if you have debug and non-debug code, if you have code for different compilers or target platforms, if you have headers that you need to do different things for C++ and C, then maybe that's okay. But in general, we should really try to keep code within these regions simple. So to avoid nesting ifdefs, or to ifdef entire functions if possible, rather than just parts of functions. And there's exceptions to these. Like if you'd have just one line that's, you know, ifdef debug in a function, that's probably okay. But if we have, you know, nested blocks of ifdefs within a function, it gets very difficult to understand very quickly. So Another commonly used and abused feature of the preprocessor is macros. So back in C, macros were used for all sorts of things. They were used for type generic programming of various forms. They were used for defining manifest constants in code. But in C++, we largely don't need to do those things with macros anymore. We have better language features. So as an example, if we have an enumeration with a bunch of colors and we've previously defined them as macros, this is all great until someone goes ahead and tries to define a variable named orange. And of course, the compiler doesn't like that one bit because it's gone and replaced orange with two, and it doesn't know what to do with that. Often this is solved by, we'll use all caps macro names everywhere. But this still we have the problem that there's no type checking. So, here we can pass 9,000 to this function that expects a color, even though that doesn't map to a valid color, and there's no way for the compiler to say, you need to go and do the right thing. So the solution here is of course, to use an enumeration. And in this case, we get the added benefit that since the enumerators are all in order, the compiler can go and generate them for us as well. This fixes our type checking problem mostly. So if we try to pass 9,000 to something that takes a color type, the compiler is not going to like that. But there's still some obnoxious problems with enumerators in C++, and that is that they're still convertible to their underlying type, which means we can do things like convert it to an int, or we can add two colors together. What does that mean? The second major problem is that it's quite likely that we're going to want to have two enumerators with the same name. So in this case, maybe we've got a traffic light state. I actually don't know what colors are used for traffic lights here. But in the United States, we use red, yellow, and green. And so obviously three of these conflict with our color type. And because the enumerators are actually injected into the enclosing scope, they're, they conflict. So the solution in C++ that was added in C++ 11 is a new feature called scoped enumerations. So with these, the names are not introduced into the enclosing scope. So if we want to use them, we have to qualify the enumerators with the enumeration name. They have the added benefit that they do not implicitly convert to their underlying type. So for example, if we try and convert hot pink to its underlying type, we can't. The compiler doesn't let us. You can with a cast, which is okay because the cast basically says I know what I'm doing. There's a couple other advantages to scoped enumerations. One problem with them, though, is that it's hard to use them with bit flags because since they're not convertible to int or their underlying type, you can't do a bitwise OR or a bitwise AND with them. You can, however, overload those operators for these, and so it's common to see in projects, someone will use a macro to generate code to generate all of the operators for a bit flag xenum. So enumerators don't just need to be used for enumerations. Another thing that can be done is you can define unnamed enumerations, just so that you have enumerators, So instead of having a max underscore uint32 macro, we can define an enumerator with this that's a max uint32t value. This is another feature of C++ 11 that you can actually specify the underlying type. So it used to be you couldn't specify the underlying type of the enumeration. It was always int or unsigned int or whatever the next smallest type was that could represent all the enumerators. So this is a useful feature. So in general, we should prefer to use enumerators for named constants and convert enumerators from macros into named constants where possible. Generally, this is also a very simple transformation. It makes it easier to work with the code, easier to track down where names are coming from. For things like the max uint32t, it's also common to see static const variables used, often in older code where we don't have the ability to specify the underlying type of an enumerator. But in general, now an enumerator with the underlying type is often preferable. So when finally, if we need to interop with C, so if we have a header that needs to work in both C code and C++ code, macros are often necessary because you can't specify the underlying type in C. Enumerators are not usable as manifest constants in C because they're not constant expressions. So there's a handful of reasons for that. And the other problematic case of macros are those macros that should actually be functions. So here's a quintessential example of this, and this is actually based on something from the C runtime sources. So we have this function, make care lowercase, that takes an ASCII character, and it converts it to lowercase in place. So it actually goes and it tests, oh, is it an uppercase character? And if it is, you know, set it to its lowercase value instead. So this doesn't look so bad. I mean, it's a horrific looking macro with 20 parentheses in its definition, but the problems arise when someone goes ahead and says, ah, well, now I want to make a whole string lowercase, so I'm going to write a function to do that. And so this function apparently has, I mean, it doesn't look like there's anything wrong with it. It's going to iterate over the entire string and make each character lowercase. Except that when the compiler gets to this, it's going to see that make char lowercase and basically replace every instance of C with that dereferencing of S++, and we end up with this. So we end up actually incrementing S multiple times every iteration through the loop, and you know, we'll be very lucky if this doesn't crash or run off the end of an array or modify, you know, random parts of memory. So it's fairly straightforward, you know, to convert these sorts of macros into inline functions. And not only, you know, does this improve usability, because we can then go and implement our make string lowercase the same way we had before, and it's correct, but it's easier to read. Like, I can actually read this code. You're not limited to one expression. You can use various statements. So the last point I'll make about this is that it's much easier to debug this. So with the macro, there's no way for the debugger to step through the macro and say, ah, here's the part of the expression that I'm working with. But with the inline function, it has all the type information, it has all the debug information, so it can actually, you know, you can step through it, you can set breakpoints. One common concern with this is that, oh, now there's a function call, so, you know, there's going to be some overhead because of the function call. In general, the compiler is really good at inlining any kind of function that, you know, is very short. You know, in this case, we've only got, I don't know, two or three branches and some subtraction. So I would be very surprised if this was not inlined at the call site with optimizations enabled. So functions are easier to read and maintain. They're easier to write. Again, you're not restricted to a single expression. They're easier to debug through. And they behave better according to, you know, programmer expectations. And because there's no performance overhead for the most part, they should generally be preferred. So we're going to look next at using RAII. And we'll start off with, you know, that horrible example from MSDN. So what we'd really prefer to do here, you know, rather than having this arrow code of, oh, you know, all these things, have they succeeded, and now we can finally get to what we want, is we'd much rather have something that's nice and linear, easy to understand, where we just bail out the first time that something, you know, that something goes wrong. Linear code like this is much easier to debug through, because, you know, once you've gotten to line 40 of the function, you know, okay, I'm in a valid state, everything's good to go. And so the problem that, you know, prevents us from doing this is anytime we have code that looks like this, there has to also be some code that looks like this, and this is actually the bottom half of that that function. So, you know, we can't suddenly start bailing out because, oh, we have this raw pointer here at the top. We've gone and co-create instance to create that, and, you know, at the end of the function, we need to free it. So I want to simplify this with a simpler example. So let's say we have a function that needs to allocate two buffers of some particular size, and then it's going to do something with them, and it needs to free the buffers. So this is a simple example of, this is a correct function that would do this. Obviously, the solution here is, you know, to use some kind of RAII container. I hope everyone here is familiar with RAII at least a bit. Okay. So there's obviously no RAII container, so we need to find something that is suitable for this. The ideal thing would be to use a std vector. Unfortunately, if we have a lot of code where we're doing manual resource management already, we really do not want to introduce std vector, because std vector will use operator new, which will throw on failure. And the last thing we want to do is introduce exceptions into a code base that is not exception safe. So one option that we can use here is unique putter. And so here's an example of what we might do using the non-throwing new. If we really wanted to use malloc, that's also easy to do with unique putter. We just need to define our own custom deleter. So this is a delete that uses the free function. And then we use that for each of the unique putters that we for the pointer we allocate with malloc. But unique putter is not ideal for everything. It's very useful for some types of buffers. One case where it's not particularly a good idea is actually that first co-create instance that we were looking at. So for that code, we actually need to take the address of the pointer because it's used as an out parameter. And so if we were to try and use the unique putter, you know, with a special deleter that does the right thing and calls IUnknownRelease, then this will end up with a compilation error because we take the address of the unique putter, which is of the wrong type, and there's no guarantee that the pointer is the first member of the unique putter, so we can't do any kind of cast magic to make this work. So thankfully, there's another type, computter, that can be used here. Computter is from WRL. There's also ccomputter from ATL library that can be used for com types. So even, you know, in cases where, you know, unique putter is not useful, other types are present to be used instead. So, like, as a general rule, it's best to keep functions linear. It's best to take these functions that are heavily nested, that have lots of complexity, to linearize them because it makes them easier to understand and it makes them easier to modify during maintenance and bug fixing. There was somebody, and I don't remember, I tried to find it on Twitter. Somebody had tweeted the suggestion that perhaps the as a potential complexity metric, we might consider the area under the indentation. So if you were to, you know, draw a shape with the with all the indentation in a correctly indented function, you know, the larger that area gets, the more complex the function is. So this, you know, this implies that, okay, if we have a short function, you know, with a bunch of nested loops, maybe that's okay. Or if we have a really long function that just does one thing after the next, and there's very little indentation, then that's probably also okay. But as soon as we start getting really long functions that are really heavily indented, we start ending up with maintenance problems. So I don't know that, you know, this is a perfect metric, but it's certainly one that, you know, you can easily eyeball some code and say, wow, this code is, you know, really complex and horrible to work with. So the second recommendation, that even in legacy code, even when we're not using exceptions, we should still be using RIII. So this is a first step toward making code exception safe. We have to, you know, make sure that if an exception is thrown, everything gets cleaned up correctly. But even if we're not using exceptions, like, this allows us to return early from functions. It frees us from having to worry about resource management, so we don't have to go hunting to make sure that on every exit path we've gone and cleaned things up. Basically, single exit and go-to-based cleanup should never be used anymore in new code, and it's best to try and modify old code to get rid of those patterns. This is, I would argue, the single easiest way to improve C++ code quality, though it's not always easy to switch to RIII-based resource management. So I mentioned before that if you have a code base that is not exception safe, it's not always easy to introduce, you know, usage of new C++ libraries. So in our example, you know, we wanted to start using studvector because studvector provides a whole bunch of useful utilities, but it relies on a throwing new. There's no way to use it with a new that doesn't throw, unless you like access violations on out-of-memory errors. So the problem here is that, you know, if we start introducing throwing code, it's going to, you know, those exceptions are going to unwind through parts of the stack where we aren't going to clean things up because we don't have objects with destructors in place. So one thing we can do is we can use well-defined exception boundaries. And we can basically divide our code into two parts, and that division may be, you know, in various places, where, you know, within certain bubbles of the code, we can use exception throwing code. And then, you know, within the rest of the code base, we don't use exceptions. So we'll start off with our basic boundary function. So in this case, I've made it an extern C function. So it's a C function. It should never throw an exception. It should always, you know, return something. And in this case, I've made it return an H result just because H results are a convenient error code type that most people are familiar with. It could be an error note T. It could be basically any kind of error code. But this is just for example. So if we wanted to start using throwing code, the basic pattern that we'll need to use, you know, is a try catch, and we catch all the exceptions, and, you know, on any kind of exception, we return a failure H result. So here, within that try block, we could, you know, certainly use std vector. Now, this isn't particularly great because, you know, we're not reporting any useful error information when we could actually detect, oh, well, we have a bad alloc exception, so we can return E out of memory. Though many components seem to just return E fail all the time, because why not? So of course, we can, you know, go and add more catch blocks to go and handle individual exception types. So for example, if we have, you know, our my H result error type that we're using in our code base, we can return the H result from that, or we can handle std bad alloc from operator new. And then on unknown exceptions, we can, you know, do whatever our policy is. We could return efail like before. Generally, the preferred method now would probably be actually just to terminate the process. We do this, we've started doing this a lot in new Microsoft code, that when a logic error is detected like this, when an exception that you're not expecting is detected, or when a failure occurs that should never occur, that taking down the process is usually the best thing to do for security reasons, that, you know, we don't want unexpected conditions propagating through a process. So the problem with this is that it's likely that we're going to have an awful lot of boundary functions. In a common library, there may be hundreds of functions like this. And so we don't want to have to duplicate this all over the place. Like, that would be terrible from a maintenance point of view, of having to copy this, and then every time we go and, you know, add a new exception or need to start handling a new exception, we need to add another case. So one way to deal with that would be a macro. You know, we could easily do this with a macro, but as I said before, we should probably not use macros for this kind of purpose. So one technique that I picked up from John Kalb is that we can use a function to do the translation for us. So we can do a catch-all block, and then we can translate the exception using this exception translation function. And what it does is it just does a throw without any argument. And what this does is, if an exception is currently being handled, it re-throws that exception in that context so that you can handle the exception. So here it'll re-throw it, and if it's, you know, if it matches one of these three, then it'll handle that case. There's another solution that I think is actually a bit cleaner than this. That uses C++11 lambdas. This is a trick that I learned from the Visual Studio SDK. We have a function called callWithComConvention that we use for wrapping .NET code that may throw for implementing COM APIs. And what we do here is, instead of having the implementation of the function directly in the function, we wrap it in a lambda, and then we pass the lambda to this translation function. And in there, we start a try block, and we go and we actually call the function from within that context. So basically, we're wrapping up this chunk of code, and then we're passing it into this function to be executed there. And that allows us to more easily handle all the exceptions. So I actually really like this technique. We've been using it in a number of places. I like it. So the next thing I want to look at is the glorious const keyword. So I think everybody here is probably familiar with const correctness, which should be the bare minimum. All APIs should be const correct. There's lots of literature written on this subject. Const has been around for decades, so most code generally falls into this category of const correctness, that if you're not modifying an object via pointer or reference, you know, you make that pointer or reference const, and then member functions that don't mutate an object should also be const. But I'd like to actually, I'd like to go a step further and say that almost everything should be const qualified, that by default we should be declaring things as const, and that when maintaining legacy code, it's really useful to start littering the code with the const keyword and going to see what breaks. So as an example of this, I have a function here called readElements. And what it does is it takes a buffer, and it's a buffer of elements of a particular size, and then there's a particular number of those elements. So this is this looks a lot like the fread function in the std.io library. So in this function, it computes the actual size of the buffer by multiplying the element size and the element count. And in reality, we want to do an overflow check there, but for the moment, this is, you know, just for example purposes. It then computes, you know, the beginning and the end of the buffer, and then it iterates over the buffer, and it reads bytes using this read byte function that exists somewhere. So, you know, what can we const qualify here? Well, we can start off by all of the parameters can be const qualified. We don't modify any of these in the function, so there's no reason that we can't throw the const qualifier on there. Now, I'll note that we've const qualified the buffer pointer, not the actual pointed to void, because we are going to write into the buffer. We can also const qualify the buffer size, because we compute that once. We're not going to go and modify that. And we can const qualify both the first and the last iterators that we have. So the benefit here is that when we're going through and we're debugging code, assuming that nothing goes terribly wrong and someone goes off writing off the end of a buffer, we can assume that, you know, all of these things are not going to change. So when I've been working with legacy code, I found it's often useful to just go and const qualify everything, go and recompile the code and see what's broken, and try to refactor code so that that we can leave the const qualifiers in place. So either by introducing new local variables by changing things so that we don't need to modify quite so many parts of so many variables. In general, the fewer moving parts that you have in code, the better off that your code is going to be, the easier it is to debug. And so this helps to eliminate moving parts because you can't modify const objects. So in general, I would strongly recommend, you know, const qualifying everything that you can in new code. And then, you know, when you're maintaining existing code, go throw new const qualifiers all over the place. There are a few things that shouldn't be const, though. Notably, data members should not be const because they make it impossible to assign from one object to another. And in general, constness of data members should be maintained through, you know, member function invariants. By-value return types should not be const. There's no reason to make them const if they're built-in types. And then for class types, it's just an arbitrary restriction on callers of the function. Obviously, if you're returning a pointer or a reference, those should be appropriately const qualified. Class type local variables that may be moved from. So with C++ 11, we had a new feature called R-value references and move semantics. So you can actually move the contents out of an object. But if you're going to move from an object, then you can't, that object can't be const, because moving implies that you're actually taking its contents away from it and putting them somewhere else. And so, you know, if you're taking it away from them, then, you know, you're necessarily mutating it. So if you're going to do that, those local variables should not be const. And I'll note that in many cases, this may actually, if you do const qualify those things, it may not actually be an error that the compiler can detect. So for example, if you have a std vector with a million ints in it, and then you try and it's const qualified, and then you try and move from it, the compiler will just invoke the copy constructor instead, because that's a matching overload. The other case is any local variables that you may return from the function for the same reason. So if you have a type that is movable and or copyable, and you return it from a function by value, one of two things can happen. Either the compiler can elide the copy, or if it can't elide the copy, it will try and move the object out if that's possible. Unfortunately, if the object is declared as const, then there's no way for the compiler to move it out, again, because the move constructor won't match during overload resolution, because it requires a modifiable object. So I'd like to talk about C-style casts. I want to start with an example. So let's say that we have something P, and we use a C-style cast to cast it to this class type pointer. What actually happens here? And there's no good answer to this, because one of five things can happen here, and it depends entirely on the type of P. So a C cast will do one of five things. It'll either do a const cast, a static cast, it'll do both of those, or it'll do a reinterpret cast, or a reinterpret cast with a const cast. So that previous slide, this might be removing const qualifiers. It might be converting, you know, from an integer type to a pointer type. There's all sorts of things that might be going on here. It's impossible to tell from this one line of code what's going on. Whereas, you know, if we have a static cast, then generally, you know, we'd look at that and we say, oh, that's, you know, that's fairly safe. There's, you know, yes, there's some dangerous uses of static cast, but generally it's much safer and much less terrifying than, you know, a const cast. Why are we removing, you know, const qualifiers? Or a reinterpret cast, which, you know, who knows what might be going on depending on the source type. So, you know, various things might happen with this code example. If P is a pointer to a const class type, then, you know, we're going to remove that const qualifier, which, why are we doing that? If it's a type related to a class type, then it will do a static cast, possibly combined with a const cast. And finally, you know, if it's of a type unrelated to class type, like if it's a void star or an int star or a, you know, even an unsigned integer, then it'll, you know, it'll do a reinterpret cast. But there's a problem even here, because with that second bullet, it says if P is of a type related to class type, it does a static cast. But we can consider another example. What happens if we have two structures, A and B, and we have a B star, and then we use a C cast to convert it to an A star? So in this particular isolated example, the compiler has no way of knowing whether those types are related. So you will always get a reinterpret cast in this case. The compiler is just going to take the pointer and convert it to the other pointer type. But in fact, in this case, you know, A might be derived from B, or B might be derived from A, and that might be the wrong thing to do. There may be extra, you know, bookkeeping information for virtual pointers, and so the compiler needs to actually compute an offset to do the right thing. There may be other base classes of one of those types that, you know, would introduce problems for this. So because the compiler doesn't know here, it's going to use a reinterpret cast and potentially do the wrong thing. The other place where C-casts are especially dangerous are in any kind of type hierarchies where you have virtual base classes, because in this case, sometimes a dynamic cast is actually required to convert from one type to the other, and the C-cast will just fall back to doing a reinterpret cast, which is practically never correct. So it's usually very, very easy to go through and, like, whenever you see a C cast, you know, convert it to what you think the cast should be. And if that doesn't work, then you know that, oh, wait, maybe something weird was going on here. Some people recommend that, you know, C cast should only be used for integer type or numeric type conversions. So, for example, you know, if you need to convert a double to an int and suppress the compiler warning associated with that, you'd use a C cast there. I actually think that even is a bad idea, because conversions between numeric types, while fairly safe, I mean, you know, converting from an int to a double or a double to an int is certainly nowhere near as dangerous as converting, you know, from one pointer type to another. They're still not necessarily safe, because, for example, converting from a signed integer to an unsigned integer, you may end up, you know, converting small negative values to extremely large positive values. So the static cast, you know, gives you a much better syntactic handle that you can look at that and say, ah, there might be something fishy going on here. So the last section that I have is on loops. So this is a bit of a stretch goal. This is something that I've been working with in hobby projects for a while. And so everything so far has hopefully been, you know, rather practical, and this can be a bit of a stretch goal for people. The question is, how can we improve loops to make them easier to understand and to improve the reusability of the code? And so we'll start off with a little example. So we've got this main function, and we have a vector full of integers, and we want to find the maximum value. And so we write a little loop that iterates over all the elements of the vector, and we do so by computing its size and then, you know, iterating using an index and the subscript operator. And so this works. It'll compute the maximum value. It would actually be preferable, though, to write this using iterators. So, you know, iterating from v.begin to v.end. The reason that this is preferable is that within the loop, we don't need to do any subscripting. We have direct access to the element via the iterator. In general, I've found that people are much less willing to go and do funny things with iterators or pointers in a loop than they are with indices. Like, when people have an index, there's this weird passion for just, oh, we'll add one to get the next element or things like that. And I've found that, in general, that doesn't happen with iterators and pointers nearly as much. So in C++ 11, we could also implement this using a range for loop. So this is an even easier way, and it's even safer, because you don't even have the induction variable. You can actually just, you know, you only have the elements, so you actually can't do anything funny. But this code is still not very good, because there's actually a function that will do that entire loop for us. and it's called max element, and it just takes the range and it will give you an iterator to the maximum element in that range using the operator less than for comparison. There's a whole library of these algorithms in the standard library, and they're grossly underused. I hope everyone's familiar with some of them, like std sort, perhaps std binary search to do a binary search over sorted ranges. But there's a bunch of seemingly obscure algorithms that are extremely useful in ordinary regular code that we write on a daily basis. Two examples that come to mind are partition, which will take a partition condition and it'll partition a range into two pieces. So it's kind of like doing the first stage of a merge sort. The other one is rotate, that'll take elements in a range and it'll rotate them around a pivot point. And by using these and by trying to use algorithms as much as possible and not using loops, we can actually substantially improve the quality of our code. And there's a great talk on this subject that you can find from the Going Native conference that we held in Redmond last September that Sean Parent gave, called C++ Seasoning. And in this talk, he gives a few great examples using partition and rotate in particular. But he also goes into a number of other C++ style issues that I'd highly recommend it. It's one of the best talks I've seen in basically ever. So to recap on these things, these are some of the things that we found, improving our own legacy code, trying to make improvements. Eliminating complexity introduced by the preprocessor, refactoring functions to try and linearize them and shorten them. We definitely try to update any manual resource management to use RAI wherever possible. We litter your code with the const qualifier, convert CCAST to C++ CAST where possible, and then trying to convert from algorithms instead of loops. So we haven't actually been able to do that last one in our legacy C code bases, largely because we sit underneath the C++ standard library. So for logical reasons, we can't go and use pieces of it. But all of these other things, we've started applying these. So most of our C sources we now compile as C++. We've raised the warning levels on almost everything. We try to use RAI in most places. There's some places where we're still working to, build the primitives that we need for low-level systems code. But, even in most of the time, that's a fairly straightforward process. So are there any questions? There are no questions. Yeah. So it's the question was why add the const qualifier to by value parameters? So I'll go back to that slide. So it doesn't mean anything for the caller. So the caller is going to pass you an int. It's going to be a copy of the int that you have in the function. So it has nothing to do with whether or not you can modify their int. What does matter, though, is that when you're debugging through this function, because that's const qualified, it's never going to change. So you don't have to worry that, somewhere in a very long function, somebody's going to go and modify that to change the value of the buffer size or the element size. So it has nothing to do with const correctness, which is about interface correctness and being able to, verify that, when I call this function, it's not going to modify my stuff. It has everything to do with helping you to debug your code.
Yeah, so it's about the logic inside
your function. Right. All right, well, this was a bit shorter than I anticipated, but yeah.
Do you have any experience with managed C++?
I do have a bit of experience with both managed C++ and C++ CLI that superseded the original managed extensions. So if we're modernizing that,
yeah, well, if you're using that, is there any ways to do that?
Certainly, if you're using the old managed extensions for C++, I'd strongly recommend moving toward the newer C++ CLI language extensions for a number of reasons, the most important being that it's much more obvious when you're using managed types. So in the old managed extensions, like, we used asterisk for managed types, and so it would mean different things depending on what the pointer type was. In C++ CLI, we actually, we use the hat and we use a ref, GC new and other related things like that. In terms of modernizing, a lot of this applies as well. I think it's also beneficial to go and try and refactor the interfaces often to try and reduce the amount of code that's in the actual C++ CLI part and increase the amount of code that's in the pure C++ part. This can often be different, especially where string types, I find, are often the biggest problem. That, it's very easy once you have a system string in your code, it's very easy to, use system string all over the place, rather than having to convert to, a std string or a, some other string primitive. But because, there's a lot of tools that are available for native C++ that aren't available for managed C++, increasing the amount of code that can be compiled purely as native and using the managed C++ purely as a wrapper around that, for interop with native, with managed code, is probably the best use of time. Like I said, that can certainly be difficult, especially if you have a lot of C++ CLI code. Certainly, one of the projects I worked on before I joined Microsoft was a 3D simulation system. And so our core was written in C++, and then our UI was all written in C++ CLI. And I think the biggest problem that we actually ran into was not so much with code quality, but was with the ease with which, when working in that environment, you can forget that you're working with two different object models. That on the one hand, you have this lovely deterministic C++ object model, and on the other hand, you've got this ugly, managed object model with non-determinism and garbage collection. And so, by enforcing a strict boundary between the managed parts and the native parts, it becomes easier to avoid mixing those two. Cool. So on that note, I'm happy to answer any other questions, but yeah.
Yeah, I might have, not perhaps not totally related, but you mentioned the two books on refactoring.
Mm-hmm.
Do you use any tools specific, perhaps no Microsoft tools yourself, to refactor C++ legacy code?
Yeah, so the question is, do I use any tools for refactoring C++? So we actually do have... I don't know if it was actually released as part of one of our updates or if it's just as a CTP online, but we do have we have been working on refactoring tools for C++. So we have tools now that, if you have a member function definition and then a declaration, you can synchronize their parameter lists or things like that. I've forgotten what all is in that. I actually prefer not to use tools for this. I find that, yes, there's some mechanical, okay, yes, I'm just, copying this declaration or copying and pasting pieces of the code around. I often find that gives me time to think about, is this really the right design? And oftentimes I'll be doing this and be like, wait, no, maybe we should do this differently to avoid, this repetition I'm putting in. Or, yes, I definitely see the benefit of, saying, okay, we're going to use, these new tools and automate these processes. And certainly the automated processes can help reduce error because anytime, people, are modifying code, there's more likely to have errors than when a computer's doing it. But even so, I think that the design opportunities to actually think through the design and make sure, oh, I'm really doing the right thing, are beneficial. Cool. Well, thank you, everyone. I know there's a review thing or something, so especially if you really hated this session, please fill it out so that I know, for next time.